call the redistricting committee meeting in order.
I want to thank everyone. My name is Chris Wazinski. I represent 21A in the legislature. I want to thank the committee for making the trip down to Marshall, Minnesota to hear the concerns of folks out this neck of the woods. I appreciate all the folks that are going to be testifying here today, talking about the unique things that we have, the unique things as far as demographic change that we have out here in southwest Minnesota. Kind of just have a fair open process when we're looking at the design of the new districts and keep this conversation going as much as possible. With that, I want to thank Sarah Anderson for bringing everyone down and the rest of the committee members. So with that, thank you very much. Look forward to the hearing today. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Swizinski. We've had an interesting lunch at the bistro today, so it's nice to see a little piece of Marshall before we came here today. And I too want to thank everyone that was able to come here today, especially the members coming down to Marshall. We have one member that is from the big northern tip of Minnesota, so he's got a long ways to travel tonight after we get home, Dan Fabian. But what I'll do here, if I could, is first just go through a little bit of introductions so you know who all of us are. And I'll start us off. I'm Sarah Anderson. I'm the chair of the redistricting committee, and I represent House District 43A, which is Plymouth and Medicine Lake. It's a western suburb of the Twin Cities. So pleasure to be here today, and I'll have everybody else go around. I only ask that everybody try to use microphones because we are recording the meeting for the legislative record. So if you're not at a microphone, if you come to a microphone and make sure that your voice is heard. Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Fernan, the committee administrator.
I'm Representative Melissa Hartman from the suburbs around Minneapolis. I'm about 22 miles north of Minneapolis. I represent Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids.
I'm Representative Dan Fabian, excuse me, and I represent Roseville, Kitson, Marshall, and Bennington County. I live in Roseville, and it's about 360 miles from St. Paul. So.
I'm Mary Murphy. I'm representative of District 6B, which is north and west of Duluth, and I have five cities, parts of two counties, five school districts in my legislative district.
Good afternoon, I'm Patrick Rothko. I represent Farmington, Lakeville, and portions of rural Dakota and Indian counties.
Hi, thanks for being here today. I'm Peggy Scott, and I represent Andover and Hamlet, northern suburbs.
I'm Joe Hoppe. I represent the eastern part of Carver County. If you look on the little map here, I'm all of this. This is my legislative district. I'm Shasta Ward 4. Just right there, a little jog there. Thank you.
And I'm Kate Hensley. I'm with PLA.
Okay, I think we've got everybody here. I also want to thank staff for getting all the taping equipment put together and all the folders. There are handouts. If you didn't get one, please just let us know. But they are pushing it to come all the way around the room, so make sure you get a chance to see those handouts. And then also, I just wanted to go over the reason for us coming to Marshall today is to go over the redistricting process. This is something that happens every 10 years, and it all starts with the U.S. Constitution, basically, in saying that we every 10 years have to go through the reapportionment process with our congressional districts. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but Minnesota was projected to lose one of our eight congressional districts, but we were fortunate enough to keep all eight, and we're happy about that. And it's all due to folks like you and being diligent about filling out the U.S. Census form. So encourage you to do that next go around too, and your neighbors as well. For today's purposes, just want you to know, we want to make sure that you have a chance to ask any questions that you may have of us. If you have any input too, please do that. We just ask that you make sure that you use the microphone so we get your comments recorded through this whole process.
Yeah.
And Chris was right, when it comes to the redistricting process, our goal is to put forth a redistricting plan that is fair to all Minnesotans and that encompasses all 134 House seats and our 67 Senate seats, as well as our 8 congressional seats. And with this plan, what our challenge is that we will be looking at the population data that we're expected to get in mid-March, And we'll have to recognize the population and demographic shifts and put together a fair plan based off of that. And just to kind of give you a little background for the redistricting process, it's the U.S. Constitution says every 10 years that we must go through this process. All 50 state legislatures must redraw their legislative and their congressional district boundaries. These new boundaries are based on the population figures that are provided by the U.S. Census Bureau, and as I mentioned earlier, those will come in mid-March. When we redraw them here in Minnesota, we have 201 legislative seats. As I mentioned before, the 134 House seats, the 67 Senate seats, and then the 8 congressional seats that we redraw. And we've already begun this process by holding a couple of hearings at the state capitol. We've held hearings on studying the history of redistricting in the state of Minnesota. We have also done a review of the different population and demographic shifts in Minnesota since 2000, and we have some experts here today that will go into greater detail, so you have that information as well. Again, you know, our plan is just to make sure that we put out a fair plan, and we do it just like any other piece of legislation. The House will put forth a bill that has the redistricting plan for the House. The Senate will put forth a bill with their redistricting plan. It will hopefully we'll be able to come to an agreement on what the overall plan will be that will then be sent to the governor. So it's no different than any other piece of legislation. Once it goes to the governor, it's up to the governor on whether or not he signs the bill. So that's how that part goes. So you should know that much of what we do is required by U.S. Supreme Court case law, the Federal Voting Rights Act, as well as the Minnesota Constitution and some Minnesota statutes. There's many factors that go into developing a fair redistricting plan for Minnesotans. There's the issue of districts that need to be substantially equal in population. And believe it or not, this hasn't always been the case. Prior to the 1960s, we had legislative districts that were not equal in size. And we had as much of a difference of one seat being 100,000 to another seat being 20,000. So in the 1960s, that all changed, and we got into the practice of making sure that we have equal proportion in population. And that's also due to the U.S. Supreme Court cases that have happened on this issue. When it comes to the congressional districts, they have to have a zero deviation in population. It is truly one person, one vote. So you can't be off the, you know, more than one person, essentially, is what you're looking at. For the legislative districts, our goal is to be, you know, plus or minus 1% in deviation. And we are also required to make sure that the districts are made up of convenient, contiguous territories supported by Article 4, Section 3 of the Minnesota Constitution. And all precincts must be connected geographically. And what I mean by that is they can't have one piece here and a separate piece not connected to all of here. They have to be compacted connected. Another consideration in the redistricting process should be for preserving communities of interest where practical. And we will work to make sure that we prevent the dilution of the voting strength of racial or language minority populations, and in cases where possible, increase the probability of members of the minority that they will be elected. So again, our ultimate goal is to develop redistricting plans for both the legislative and congressional districts that fairly represent all Minnesotans and recognize the population demographic shifts within our state. So again, just want to thank you for coming. If you haven't had a chance to sign in or haven't gotten your handouts, please do that now. And I look forward to hearing what your comments are. And we're going to start off with our state demographer, Tom Glaspy, who has done this how many times now, Tom?
Okay. This is my fourth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and citizens of Southwest Minnesota. You have in front of you two handouts that, in which I've tried to summarize some of the big changes that we have seen in Minnesota and particularly in Southwest Minnesota over the past decade, as it might affect redistricting. First, just a little bit about the total population. Minnesota added about 7.8% of our population and nearly 350,000 people last decade. We have a little over 5.3 million people in the state. Minnesota and South Dakota led the Frost Belt states, Northeast and Midwest states, in total population growth, and South Dakota has, and basically we grew at about the same rate. South Dakota just barely edged us out at 7.9%, but don't tell them that, they might. Minnesota ranked 26th in percent change overall and 21st in among states in the number of people changed. Texas added 4.3 million people for the biggest gain during the decade, and Nevada had the largest percentage gain at more than 35%. And one additional thing is that most of Minnesota's population gain was in populations of color, in our minority populations, accounted for about 65% of our total growth in the last decade. There are several other states in the country that have that are about the same size as Minnesota. We're catching up on Wisconsin, but we're still slightly behind them. Wisconsin still has 8 congressional seats, and Minnesota has 8 congressional seats. Colorado is catching us up fairly quickly, and right now they have 7 congressional seats. So they're coming on fairly strong. California has the most with 53. And Wyoming, as well as our neighbors to the west, both North and South Dakota, each have 1 congressional seat. That's the fewest that you can have. You have to have at least, each state has to have at least 1 congressional seat. Over the past decade, in fact, not just the past decade, but the past 3 or 4 or 5 decades, the central part of the United States, the great heartland of the United States, most of the counties have declined in population. That is true in the Dakotas and through Nebraska, Kansas, eastern Colorado, Oklahoma, and north central Texas. Most of that area has seen population loss over a substantial period of time, and that is also true in southwestern Minnesota, with a number of counties experiencing a long-term population loss. Most of the growth in Minnesota occurred in the ring around the Twin City metropolitan area, and stretching up to St. Cloud and then down to the Rochester area, where the overwhelming proportion of our total growth occurred. One thing of most of the, if we look at that big increase in the minority population in Minnesota, most of that increase occurred in the Twin City metropolitan area, in counties such as Hennepin and Dakota and Anoka counties. But I might point out also that Nobles County has one of the highest proportions, ranking 5th among counties in the state, with the 5th highest proportion of people of color. As I said, Minnesota, we kept our 8 congressional seats. Iowa lost a seat this time. Wisconsin lost a seat last time, 10 years ago. The congressional voting strength of the upper Midwest has been eroding for a number of decades. Minnesota is one of the few places, one of the few states that has held our own. We have held constant at 8 since 1960, but this time we were literally the last seat apportioned. We were the dividing line. That 8th seat was the dividing line. I have made population estimates of our congressional and legislative districts, and I might say that we are waiting right now for the final results of the 2010 census to use for redistricting, and that will give us information on county population, city and township, all the way down to very small areas, blocks within the cities and townships of the state, as well as election precincts. That'll be the only piece of data that will show election precinct data. That should come within the next month, or pretty much has to. We're hoping that within the next few weeks that we will receive that data. The Census Bureau is releasing that on a phased basis They are normally given just a few days' notice prior to the release, and so we're anxiously awaiting those data. In the meantime, I have made estimates of population of legislative and congressional seats to begin to think about the process and begin to think about where we are. When we look at congressional seats, we have two suburban congressional seats, the north suburban seat and the south suburban seat. And there's a larger map here behind me that you may want to look at, that those two seats are substantially larger than the equal population number. The first congressional seat district is a bit smaller than the equal population number. The seventh district is substantially less than the equal population number. Both of those districts, if the same configuration is kept, and that's up to the legislature, but if they keep the same configuration, both of those districts will need to expand in size, and they intersect here in southwestern Minnesota. Over the past decade, the average state House district has increased by nearly 2,900 people, the average Senate district by approximately 5,700 people, and the average U.S. House seat has increased by about 48,000 people, so that now the state House seats, as of the 2010 redistricting, will average in size approximately 39,600 people. The state Senate seats will average approximately 79,200 people, and congressional districts, it's about 663,000 people in a congressional district. And basically all of those districts are expanding in size over time. There are some maps of the congressional districts and also the legislative districts, but I'll ask you to focus in on the one that looks most closely at southwestern Minnesota, and there most of the counties in southwestern Minnesota have declined in population. There's a separate sheet here that shows the individual counties by legislative district in southwestern Minnesota. This is the estimated population change for 2000 to 2009. These are the entire county, so it's not representing just the portion within those districts. But you can see that the counties in southwestern Minnesota have declined in population. And one of the issues that has been raised in the past is splitting of counties in legislative districts. District 21B now has parts of two counties, Redwood and Watonwan County, in addition to Brown County. District 24A has parts of Watonwan County and parts of Faribault County, in addition to Martin County. And in addition to that, Nobles County and Yellow Medicine counties are also split. So there has in the past been some splitting of counties, and the attempt has been to hold cities whole for legislative districts. In looking at the 2009 estimate that I've made, I looked at the smallest five and the largest five as of 2009. These are all started out roughly equal in population in 2002. Now, of the five smallest districts, four are in southwestern Minnesota, with the fifth being on the Iron Range, District 5A. The five largest districts are all in suburban ring around the Twin Cities, especially in Carver, Scott, Sherburne, and Wright counties. And perhaps I should stop there and see if there are any questions, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, there should be some packet of materials that I think have been handed out to the members of the audience as well as to members of the committee. This is where I'm going to be working from my presentation. Now that you've heard the numbers from Mr. Gillespie, I'm going to sort of go through and talk about the actual process of redistricting, particularly with some focus on requirements and standards for local units of government. I'll talk about counties. I'll talk about counties, cities, and townships, as well as school districts in just a minute. But first, I'm going to start with just a little sort of visual overview of how exactly districts work and interact within the state. And that's, I think, is the last thing that's been stapled in your packet. It's the picture of colored maps of Carver County. And the reason I included this in the packet is just to sort of give you an idea of the different layers of districting that we have in Minnesota and the way that the political boundaries are set up. So once you start to see maps and see plans being developed, you'll be able to understand a little bit better, you know, how they interact, and when you hear the terminology, you'll be able to sort of visually kind of get an idea of what people are talking about. So I'll start with the side that has the four different boxes. It's Carver County. It's the sample that I use, but here in Lyon County, the structure is going to be basically the same. The top upper left-hand picture, of course, is Carver County. Those are the basic political boundaries. Everybody kind of knows what counties look like. But when you add the next layer of political divisions within the county, the Census Bureau refers to these as minor civil divisions. In Minnesota, we call them cities and townships. All the territory within the county is divided into some type of political division like this, either a city or a township. In some more rural areas, there's also unorganized territories. And you can see the cities on the map here, sort of the splotches that are sort of located throughout the county. And then the townships are the areas that are a little bit more of a grid shape. Cities and townships here are divided into precincts. And if you look at the upper right-hand corner picture there, I've zoomed into the Chanhassen and Chaska area, which Representative Hoppe noted is his district, which hadn't occurred to me until I mentioned it now, so I should have mapped his house on here probably. Within particularly populous areas, cities will divide their cities into individual precincts. And precincts are the areas, by the Census Bureau, they're called voter tabulation districts, but they're called precincts in Minnesota. And the precinct is the geographical area where all the voters live. All those that live within an individual precinct will vote at a particular polling place within that precinct. So sometimes it gets a little bit confused. It's also confused in state law. The precinct is the geographic area that you're talking about, and the polling place is the church basement or the school gym or wherever you actually go to vote. And so you can see on the map here that Chanhassen, Chaska, and Victoria are all divided into multiple precincts. So what's going to happen when the redistricting process goes forward is that the legislative and congressional district boundaries are going to be created, and they sort of overlay on top of these precincts. And so one of the responsibilities of local units of government is that once the statewide boundaries are created, the locals are going to have to adjust their precinct boundaries to conform to those statewide boundaries. And so these precincts that you see here will ultimately potentially need to change depending on what happens at the state level. The box that's in the lower right-hand corner is zoomed in just a little bit further and shows an additional layer within the precincts. All these little boxes with numbers are census blocks, and these are the little blocks that the Census Bureau designs for themselves, and that's how they go through and actually do the count of population within a territory. So the entire state of Minnesota is divided up into these census blocks. The little numbers that are within those blocks indicate the number of people that live within that area. Because if you flip over to the other side, there's a little bit closer picture. You can see how census blocks are designed. Basically, in most cases, census blocks follow main streets and roadways, rivers and streams, and other sort of major geographic areas. And when the Census Bureau is going around and counting the population, they count by these census blocks. The census blocks are also what get used to build precincts. So when a city finds out that it needs to change the boundaries of its precinct, it will use these census blocks to build the precinct itself. And so you can kind of tell the lines are a little bit off because of some mapping issues, but you can kind of tell that all of the census blocks that you see in the bigger map on the back sort of conform to the precinct boundaries that have been enacted in the city of Chanhassen. So, like I said, once the new statewide boundaries are implemented, you can kind of see how it will work. All the precincts need to nest within a particular legislative district and a particular congressional district. And if you have a city that has wards as well, precincts need to nest within those wards. So you can see if, for example, the legislature had decides to come through and create a new congressional boundary that goes down Lake Lucy Lane, it's going to split Precinct 5 and Chanhassen. And then Chanhassen will have to come back next spring and adjust their precincts to reflect those new legislative boundaries. So that's kind of how the geography works. The other part of your packet is a number of timelines and has some specific standards for particular units of government. I'll kind of walk through these somewhat quickly, but basically they're designed to be a guide to what the law requires for local units of government. It's not a comprehensive list of all the details that are required of the locals, but it's sort of a broad overview for you. The Secretary of State's office is charged in statute with developing some training materials and some other presentations, particularly for county auditors and municipal clerks related to redistricting. And I believe that they're working on doing a bigger guide that's fairly extensive and fairly detailed that will also include some other sort of best practices requirements and other types of information from what I have here. But I sort of designed these as sort of one-page kind of fact sheets for local units of government to kind of see what things are going to look like over the next year and a half or so. So I'll just kind of walk through each of these individually. And I think I'll start with the cities and townships. All of the cities and townships within the state over the next year and a half or so will need to do something related to redistricting. It may not always be the case that a city is going to actually have to draw new district boundaries. In many cases, particularly with townships and particularly with cities that only have one precinct, it may be the case that those units of government will just have to meet and reaffirm their existing precinct boundaries, and that will be fine going forward. And that's the case for the majority of cities and townships in the state. But as I mentioned, there could be cities that have multiple precincts or cities where there's significant population growth where ward boundaries will have to be adjusted to reflect the equal population requirements that exist in law. So for these cities that have to go through redistricting process, there are a number of timelines or number of deadlines that are in statute that sort of spell out the process and how it has to go to conform to the state law as well as federal law. Nothing at the local level, as I mentioned earlier, can happen until the legislative and congressional district boundaries are set. And this is because, as I mentioned, all the local districts generally need to nest within legislative and congressional district boundaries. So the reason this timeline is in statute is so a city isn't out there designing all sorts of new precinct boundaries, and then the legislature will decide they're going to come in and set a new congressional boundary that splits those precincts. So the idea is that you'll wait until the legislature has decided what it wants to enact in, next year, and then you'll come back with that new information and you can design your new precinct and ward boundaries based on those new legislative and congressional districts. So the deadline for the legislature to act is February 21st of 2012. The dates that I've used in the timeline here are sort of assuming that every step of the process is done on the last day possible. That may or may not be the case depending on whether the legislature gets an agreement on a bill. So just sort of assume when you're reading through these dates, and I mentioned them, that they could be earlier if the legislature completes its work earlier. They also could be later if the legislature doesn't complete its work on time and there aren't boundaries enacted on February 21st. There are some administrative rules that change the timelines a little bit. I didn't include them in here because I don't think it's likely to happen. It's likely that we'll either have legislative boundaries adopted into law or some court order boundaries on February 21st, but there are some backups in the administrative rule if that doesn't happen. So for cities, starting February 21st of 2012, you should have the information you need to create new precinct boundaries if you need to do that. You'll have between February 21st and April 3rd of 2012 to either reestablish your existing boundaries or to draw new boundaries. If you're a city that has wards, you'll also need to redraw your ward boundaries. If you have wards in your city, you do need to maintain some equal population requirements. Precincts don't have an equal population requirement because precincts aren't, you don't elect a person from an individual precinct. You do elect a representative from a ward. And so in order to maintain the one person, one vote standard, ward populations do need to be substantially equal in population. But as I mentioned, the deadline for action by cities and townships will be April 3rd of 2012, or 60 days following completion of the legislative district boundaries. Within that time, there is an administrative rule that requires cities and townships to acquire maps of school district boundaries within your city. This is basically to help the school district conform its own district boundaries with the new municipal precincts, so you need to do that by March 13th of 2012. As with everything else, there's also an allowance in law for a voter to challenge a local districting plan. They would have within 3 weeks of adopting a city or township districting plan to challenge that plan in court. The latest date that could happen then would be April 10th of 2012. And finally, there's some deadlines for notification to the Secretary of State and notification to voters of new precinct boundary changes, as well as new polling places. The one thing to keep in mind is if you're changing precinct boundaries, that could mean that you're changing boundaries in the way that shifts an existing polling place out of the precinct. And so there are some requirements in law for finding a place for people to vote within that precinct. I didn't include all the standards in here, but basically they need to be accessible and need to be fairly close to the precinct. So as you're drawing new precinct boundary lines, it's important to also be considering where you'll have people within that precinct actually cast their ballots on Election Day. There's a deadline of May 16th of 2012 to have those finally established. On the back of the sheet related to cities and townships, I have some standards for creating precincts. As I mentioned, when you're doing your districting plans, you'll have to follow the census block lines. After April 1st of 2012, precinct boundaries are required to follow visible, clearly recognizable features. So these would be roadways, rivers, and streams, drainage ditches, shorelines, other types of clearly visible areas that you can see from the ground. Typically, you'll do your districting plan next year, and then as your city changes and develops, if you annex territory or other things happen that require some adjustment to your precinct boundaries, you can do that. It's allowed in law. But the new boundaries that you develop, though, do have to follow these visible, clearly recognizable physical features requirement. As I mentioned, precincts are not subject to equal population requirements, although sometimes that's helpful just for purposes of distributing voters to an equal number of polling places and maintaining short lines to the extent possible. Also mentioned coordination with school districts is helpful when doing the district boundaries, just because school districts will use the same precinct boundaries that you're designing for your city council races. So coordinating with them and making sure that they're sort of conformed to the school district needs is helpful as well. One other statutory requirement that may be of interest if you're a city council member or a mayor in the room, there's the hook that I already mentioned, that a voter is allowed to challenge a districting plan that you create if they feel that it doesn't conform to the statute. There's also a requirement in law that if you don't complete your districting plan on time, the mayors and city council members within that city don't get paid until you finish your work. So keep that in mind. You'll have until, as I mentioned, April 3rd of 2012 to complete that work. There are also some additional requirements for cities and townships that have 2011 municipal elections. So if you have an election this coming fall, you'll have to reestablish your ward boundaries by this May. Most of the other deadline, I'm not going to go through this whole sheet, most of the deadlines are the same, except for cities and townships that have a municipal election this fall have until May 3rd of 2011 to reestablish your ward boundaries for use in this November's elections. Right, now I'll quickly talk about counties. Counties have a little bit different requirements for redistricting. The county board is required to redistrict county commissioner districts if they have them in their county. The county board is also responsible for doing precinct boundary lines for any unorganized territory within their particular county. So some of the same requirements that apply to precinct boundaries will apply to counties as well if they're doing this unorganized territory districting process. And finally, for county auditors, there are some additional sort of coordination requirements in law, sort of coordinating with the Secretary of State's office and local officials just to kind of maintain information flow back and forth between local units of government and the state about your redistricting process and your new ward boundaries. I don't have all those requirements included on the sheet, but they are in law. And as I mentioned earlier, the Secretary of State's office, I think, is developing some materials to help out with that. County commissioner districts, the process for redistricting county commissioners districts as well as school board member districts. Happens a little bit later in the process after both the state and congressional boundaries are done, as well as after cities and townships have completed their work. And as I mentioned, this is because you'll be building county commissioner districts based on the new precincts that cities and townships develop within their areas. And so there's sort of a three-step process. First, the state is going to enact its boundaries at the legislative and congressional level. Cities and townships are going to draw new precinct lines that will happen by April of 2012. Then after that is complete, then counties can come back and draw their county commissioner boundaries. The deadline for adopting new county commissioner districts is going to be May 1st of 2012, so you're going to have about a month after the new precinct boundary lines are drawn to create new county commissioner districts. There are also some additional publication requirements for county auditors and for county commissioners to notify voters of the fact that you've changed your precinct, the precinct boundary lines have changed, as well as the commissioner districts have districts that have changed. Those you can see on the sheet. There are also, as I mentioned, requirements for developing new polling places if you need them, and some notification requirements for the Secretary of State's office to let them know that you have changed precinct and ward boundaries and commissioner district boundaries as appropriate. On the back of the county commissioner district sheet, I have a list of the standards that are provided in statute for commissioner districts. As I mentioned, district boundaries have to be created using existing precinct lines, so that's why you're waiting until the cities and townships are complete before you draw new commissioner districts. Districts have to be composed of contiguous territory. As Representative Anderson mentioned, that means that all the land within a particular district has to be touching. Districts have to be regular and compact, as compact in form as practicable. Compactness basically means that they have to be sort of as close to like a circle or square shape as possible. So you don't want to design a district that sort of looks like an octopus or has kind of lots of sprawling territory. The idea for creating a compact district is that you keep it sort of compact as sort of one bulk of land within within the territory. The equal population requirements do apply to county commissioner districts as well, although there's a statutory allowance for districts to vary by up to 10% from the average population size of all the commissioner districts. So it's not the zero deviation that applies to congressional districts, but it is an equal population requirement with some leeway. There's also a requirement that a majority of the least populous districts contain not less than a majority of the population of the county. So read that one a couple times, and eventually it'll make sense. Finally, there's just a couple of other statutory provisions that apply to county commissioner districts. First, counties are allowed to levy a special redistricting tax to cover redistricting expenses. There's some restrictions on that in statutes that I encourage you to take a look at the law itself to find out how that works. And finally, if a person goes into court and challenges the county commissioner districts that have been drawn or argues that the county hasn't been doing due diligence to create new district boundaries, there's an allowance in statute for the court to appoint a special redistricting commission to do the work on behalf of the county board itself. And finally, for school districts, school districts have a little bit less of a load than counties and cities and townships because they're basically relying on the city precincts to draw their own member districts. The deadlines you can see here on the front, they'll have a deadline of May 1st of 2012 to complete new school board districts. Again, as with the county commissioner districts, the school board is going to be building them from city precincts, so you wait until the precincts are complete before doing new school board member boundaries. There's also an allowance for a voter to challenge the final decisions of the school board in creating new districts. And then new districts, as with all of these new districts, will take effect August 14th of 2012, which would be the state primary date in 2012. And finally, just a couple of standards for school board member districts. They also have the equal population requirement. They have the compactness and contiguity requirements. The law does allow a school district to use either census data or they're allowed to conduct their own special census of the population of their district if they want to create their member districts. And school boards, as is the case with city councils, are subject to the requirement that if they don't complete their work by the deadline, they don't get paid until they're done. So be aware of that as you move forward. And Madam Chair, that's all I have.
We're going to hear from Mr. Lucky to have him here. Tony, and the Associate Professor of Marketing and Doctor in Jackson, and Chair of the Department of Health and Regional Studies at Southwest State University. Please come up to the microphone and though I just introduced you, so many of the CA names for the
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, all present. My name's Tony Amato, Anthony Amato. I'm an associate professor of demography and geography at Southwest Minnesota State University, and I will give you all of the brevity I don't give my students. The one thing that struck me about this was that we are creating districts to serve the coming decade based on numbers from the past decade, trends from the past decade, and that's always quite difficult. The state demographer, Tom Gillespie, has often talked about crystal ball gazing, and so we have to do crystal ball gazing with a dated crystal ball here in terms of looking at the future based on past trends. And I just came up with a few ideas, a few notes, a few things to think about as people look at the future. The State Demographer's Office has made it quite clear from the numbers that they publish and the estimates they do, and soon we'll have the census numbers. And I'd like to thank the State Demographer's Office for the wonderful CorpLeft maps we have behind us and all of the data that they make readily available to all citizens of the state to look into things. And with the few things I can say, and once again, I'm giving you all the brevity that I would not give my students. Southwest Minnesota and Western Minnesota have lost population for a number of decades, both to migration and due to natural population decline, deaths exceeding births in many counties, and this is by no means new. Both trends have been evident for more than two decades. In the recent past, lead cities and then micropolitan counties have kept the region's population from absolute decline, while the most rural counties with the least populous county seats have been losing population for decades. There appears to be little out there to reverse these losses in the near future. However, how big these losses will be is another question. At the beginning of the last decade, just after last census, I had the opportunity to work with Martha McCurry in the State Demographer's Office on just doing projections of high school classes and 18 to 24-year-olds who would be the new student body at Southwest Minnesota State or potential recruits for Southwest Minnesota State. And she shared this information with me probably 2 months before she came out with her own publication of it. She let me have it confidentially, just as long as I kept it within the institution and for recruitment purposes only. And it's striking to me because what I saw 8 years ago projected and the work that I did with these numbers, actually I see when I go to high school classrooms and I see in my own classrooms smaller numbers of students. Among those students, among those 18 to 24-year-olds, larger numbers of those students are from usually immigrant backgrounds or other minority backgrounds. I just thought I'd share that little anecdote with you to make clear the changes, and also that often we talk about these numbers as though they're out there and they mean nothing, they're just numbers, but you can actually see numbers and projections do become real in front of your own eyes when you can actually go out and see your own projections right in front of your own eyes. That's something that I was really struck by. Now, in terms of schools and in terms of education, one thing that we have to keep in mind is the change is undeniable and inevitable. First-generation immigrant students and the children of immigrants and immigrants themselves are the fastest-growing population in schools. They claim a larger share of an overall shrinking high school high school and elementary school classrooms across the region and in the state. 40% of some schools' elementary school classes consist of first-generation students or immigrant students. This is quite important to note. Unlike some, I don't see the longer future as set, and I think the recent past also was more eventful and choice-filled than many think. So we can sort of look at the projections and the numbers and say, oh, there's nothing we can do about these numbers. They're set in stone. Well, even tarot card readers remind their clients, nothing is set in stone, and you have the power to choose your path. So what I'm suggesting is that we all keep this in mind in creating districts and thinking about districts, making precincts. We think about the fact that in doing so, we're actually choosing our own path, even though we're doing this based on numbers that have been handed to us. We can't change that. Actually, we're doing work in the present and for the future based on, of course, past results. It's always nice to be able to skip over notes. I'll come to one of my last points. I want it to be a prominent point. Things have changed a lot since 2008. I don't need to make that point. And a lot of assumptions that we might come away with from the 2000 numbers are from trends. Trends that existed really prior to 2008, and many things have drastically changed since then. The baby boomers themselves are aging, and many of the changes in the state, such as buying the lake house. Now the baby boomers are actually aging out of buying the lake house, and they're looking to moving to a second residence in the second phase of their retirement. So that's just an important trend for us to think about, is that even things that have been set in motion do change over time. So when we're thinking about creating new districts for the next 10 years, we have to keep in mind that the things that drove change in the last 10 years won't necessarily be the same things that will be driving change in the next 10. Another important thing to note is that agriculture, the backbone of southwestern Minnesota in many ways, or at least one of the legs of southwestern Minnesota, has reemerged as quite strong in the U.S. economy. It's one of the few growing sectors of the U.S. economy. There seems to be a future in agriculture. And I should remind my own university that there is the future, and remind my university to maintain and strengthen its agronomy program. If anything, there is a question about knowledge, particularly knowledge based on agriculture. Although southwest Minnesota might not be supporting large numbers of people through high commodities prices, knowledge of agriculture will continue to remain important and continue to remain quite important for jobs, and various things connected to agriculture will remain quite important for jobs. So if anything, I think the process of decline is always a slow process. And even though southwestern Minnesota has been gapped, it has lost ground, the losses appear to be slowing, and the gap does not appear to be widening. And as people think about drawing districts, they have to be sort of looking to the future. They have to be looking at the fact that losses will continue, but the rest of the state maybe will not be growing at such a fast pace. In other words, southwest Minnesota may be behind, but it's not getting any further behind. Nice cheery note to end my testimony. Yeah.
At this time, I'd like to invite the questions to the board on this project. You can come forward to the microphone and the board.
am Michelle Avenel Navarro. I live in Worthington, Minnesota, and I've been in Minnesota since 1977. In looking at data about women in elected office in Minnesota, what I noticed was a very big difference between the number of males and females. Since statehood, no woman has been elected governor. However, we have had 6 female lieutenant governors. The position's been held continuously, as you probably know, by women since 1983. But I also think you'd probably acknowledge that this is largely a symbolic position, not one with a lot of power. We only have had one woman in our history, Lori Swanson, as Attorney General. We've only had one state treasurer who was a female, and that was Carol Johnson, and they eliminated her position at the end of her term. Only one, Amy Klobuchar, has been elected to the U.S. Senate. We've had 3 female secretaries of state, and what I did find was very interesting. The first one didn't have a first name. She's known as Mrs. Mike Holm. No first name, 1951. And we've had 2 other secretaries of state, Joan Groh, who served for 20 years, and Mary Kiffmeyer, who served for 2 terms. We've had 3 state auditors who are female, Judy Dutcher, Patricia Anderson, and Rebecca Otto. Women are half the population of Minnesota, but we're only 31.8% of the elected representatives in the House and Senate. This includes both Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. I strongly urge you, when you're doing the redistricting, to not create obstacles to electing women and re-electing women to state office. It's important to have women in elected office. We bring a new and different perspective to issues. We make special efforts to mentor other women. And as Chatterow, Gilligan, and Reddick have stated, women are more relational, they have a greater sense of connection, they're more empathetic and caring. These qualities are very much in need at the legislature. Women's issues are also not identical to those of men. There is a gender gap. Women are more likely to favor gun control, environmental protection, support of the economically disadvantaged, and perhaps that's because we're usually part of the economically disadvantaged, support for racial equality. We usually favor laws to regulate and control vices, things like smoking, drugs, gambling, alcohol, and prostitution. Again, possibly because they affect us individually and directly. Women tend not to believe that the private sector is able to solve economic problems. They oppose the construction of nuclear power plants, and they oppose the death penalty. Issues that concern women include child care, economic equality, especially wage discrimination, educational equality, family health, domestic violence. These are issues that impact 50% of the population directly and 100% of the population indirectly. In rural Minnesota, these issues are even more difficult to address. We don't have the clout that the urban areas have. We realize that redistricting is difficult, but we also know that we need to treat women and the rural areas fairly. I believe that the 2010 census data will confirm that the population of Worthington has increased, that the diversity of our population has continued to increase, and that women continue to be underrepresented in not only well-paying jobs, but also in the legislature. As you redistrict, you must consider that communities of color exist outside the urban areas, and they also need representation. I think that you need to consider the fact that people of color and new immigrants in the rural area, while in addition to having the same concerns as those in the urban areas, also have unique concerns. Our new immigrants are Hispanic, they're Asian, and they're African, and they are female. We in Nobles County have individuals representing 53 different nations. Our new immigrants work not only in agriculture-based industries, but are also professionals. They're doctors, they're educators, they're managers, social workers, etc. And they are also business owners. Of the 34 minority-owned businesses in Worthington, 14 of them are headed by women. And again, I know that redistricting is difficult for you to take on, especially when you're looking to solve a budget gap and to put people to work. But it's imperative that you get it right. It's important that you not pit woman against woman in incumbent districts. It's important that you not eliminate representatives of communities of color. And it's vitally important that rural areas are not treated as afterthoughts. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ben Martin. Hardick, City Administrator of Marshall. Just a few points. The mayor was unable to be here today, but asked that I make a few points on behalf of, in the interest of Marshall as a community. And just a few points. First of all, you've already talked about them, that legislative districts, we believe, should reflect the common interests of the residents of the district and take that into consideration. Marshall is a region of employment, retail, healthcare, education that extends somewhere between 25 and 35 miles around the city of Marshall, as demonstrated by multiple data sources, including Deed and the census information and other private sources of data demonstrate that. We are interrelated in our communities surrounding Marshall and have common interests, from labor sheds to retail studies. Over half of the people who are employed in Marshall do not live in Marshall, and thus the importance to the surrounding region that we rely on the population around us to serve our business needs, and likewise. Marshall is a regional center of retail sales for the region as well. Based on University of Minnesota Extension study that was completed recently, we have, in comparison to what would be projected based on our population, our sales are almost double what would be projected from anticipated based on our population. We do have regional services, including regional medical center, regional airport that we provide to our area, which is important. In our population estimates show that Marshall is the only county seat regional community in southwest Minnesota to show a population increase, which is outside of the norm. On the one sheet that you have, Lyon County shows over the last 10 years a just under a negative 1.8% decrease in population. What that doesn't show is some of the breakdown within that. We did see single-digit increases in Marshall and then a few surround, maybe two or three, I think, small communities surrounding us. And again, it shows that kind of along with some of the data that regional centers continue to thrive to a certain degree, and we're not maybe thriving as much as we'd like to, but that just kind of concludes the point that when considering the legislative districting, we certainly hope that you don't look to split our region where we have interconnectedness within our within Marshall as a regional center. Thank you. Okay.
We were asking him some questions about this area before we got here, and I think he mentioned it's close to 14,000 people that come into Marshall every day to market.
Yeah, that's a good estimate. Depending on the data source you look at, I'd say that's a good estimate. Down to 14 to 20,000, I think you see.
And of those people, where are you primarily drawing from? What communities do you see a lot of?
I would say the
circle or is it a certain direction you draw from those people?
I would say it's, I should have brought some different, I've got some nice visuals I should have brought with me. It's scattered around, we don't have any real number of smaller communities of similar size that we draw on. Certainly the Cottonwoods, Tracy's, Gents, Minneota's, Lind, but we do draw up to probably 35 miles away, and so it's kind of a scattering around. I wouldn't say it's a complete, that there's like one area that it goes to. It's a pretty well diverse spread.
If you have a moment at some time, maybe share it with Representative Swizinski, or if you can email it to me, I'd be interested.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. We've got plenty of those.
Okay. And Representative Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask you to consider an idea that I think there's a couple ways to look at representing a city like Marshall and a region like Marshall. I represent a portion of the city of Brooklyn Park and a portion of the city of Coon Rapids. And some in Coon Rapids are saying, we would really like one representative that's really our representative. But right now we have three. And in fact, that's turned out to be a political advantage, because then when we want to do something for the community, for example, get the North Star train going, we have more representatives making that case. And so I take a look at Lyon County and I look at Marshall in it as being sort of the population center. And, you know, there's the two competing interests we have. One, we would like you to have one state representative so everybody knows who that person is and how to connect. But on the other hand, if you were to look at, you know, cutting Lyon County in half and having part of Lyon County in one representative's district and part in another, it really essentially doubles your political power at the Capitol. And so I don't know if you have any comment about that, but it's just a thought to take back to your city leaders as we, you know, start to look at redistricting issues. It's something to think about of whether one person really serves you better than more representation.
Thank you. I don't have any comments, but that's certainly an interesting point to think about.
Don Buell. I'm from Tyler, Minnesota, which is in Lincoln County, and I farm there. We have a grain and livestock operation. We raise hogs. That's our main occupation. And I appreciate the chance to testify to this committee. I am in District 20A. It goes from basically my farm there up to and over to there and kind of wraps around Walmart and different communities. I really struggle to understand the logic of that district, and I'll just offer that. I've never gone to Benson. It's in my district. I think it would just about kill anybody to campaign in this district, much less service that district as an effective legislator. It takes almost as long to get to the other end of the district as it does to get to the Capitol. And I'm sure others can say the same thing from northern Minnesota, but it is not logical in my mind. Another thing that probably is a point that should be made is the community aspect of the district is really absent. A lot of people in Lincoln County work in Marshall, as the previous speaker had talked about. And as far as agriculture and the kind of linkages that exist within our area, they don't exist within the district that I reside in. I do a lot of my business in the district to the south of myself and also in District 21. And so that's just my personal experience, but I guess I'd hope in the next process that there'd be a little bit more consideration for how Lincoln County and our area fits in with the district that it's placed in. I'm sure there'll be some change just based on the population. One other point that I'd like to make, I guess philosophically, I really believe in a citizen legislature where people kind of can represent their peers and people of other interests. And I don't see that happening with the present situation we have. Agriculture, as Dr. Amato said, is a real driver of this area and really of the whole state. When you look at the people that support my farm through supplies and then the people that process and distribute what we produce, our grain and livestock, it has a tremendous economic impact. So I'm hopeful that as we move forward, agriculture does have a good voice, and whether it's a male or a female that represents us, that doesn't matter to me, but agriculture needs to be represented, and those issues need to be, you know, at the table. And people from the cities, I know we've worked very well with people from the Twin Cities area on ag issues. One of the things that, in my farm, we employ two people full-time besides myself and my wife. We also have some part-time help, and this is on a farm that my mom and dad basically raised a family. But we've done it through livestock. And so I hope that in the future Minnesota continues to be a good place for agriculture and for livestock production. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about my point of view, but thank you for the chance to share that.
Thank you, Mr. Buell. I do appreciate you coming here today. I grew up in Atwater, okay. Minnesota, on a dairy farm, so
yes.
I do understand the struggles that the ag community is under right now, and appreciate you coming out to highlight some of those as well, and wanting to have communities of interest represented. When we go through the redistricting process, you know, it's all about the population and demographic shifts that we have throughout the state, and unfortunately in this area, you know, we have a loss of population, so that's going to be our challenge as we move forward on this piece. So,
you have any additional comments? We have Representative Murphy, you have a question.
Thank you. Do you have any suggestions for us if you don't want to go to, or if you've never been to Vince? Where have you been that you would like to be more often?
In the past, I've been part of a district that actually went south. Dr. Mulder was my representative, and so Lincoln County, Pipestone County, and Rock County, I think we're in the same district, and that has some logic. Also, the fact that Marshall is really a community and a center for a region, I think there's also logic for Lincoln County to be included with Lyon County. As was stated previously, there's a lot of people that work in Marshall. I have people that work with our operation that are in the Marshall area as well. So there's some partnerships we have. But either of those directions to me is much more logical, just from a business standpoint, from a community standpoint. I think District 20A would be very, very difficult to categorize as compact. Thanks for the opportunity.
My name is Anna Heckel-Smith, and I live here in Marshall, Minnesota. I'm a recent graduate of Southwest Minnesota State University, and I grew up in Slayton in Murray County. And I'm here to deliver a letter from Benjamin Vandercoy. He's a law officer, a lawyer in Windham. And I have copies here for everybody. I can read through it if you guys would like. And I also wanted to just say that I really agreed with our last speaker about representing communities of interests. Yeah.
You know what we can do? Let's distribute that.
Sure. Thank you. But Mr. Vandercoy addresses communities of interest, and he talks about health and human services and other areas where counties out here share share resources. I know for one, Lincoln and Lyon both share health and human services. And I think if I'm correct, do we also share radio towers for our sheriffs and police and fire?
We will.
You will be? And I know that our Senate district here in Lyon County stretches all the way out to New Ulm, and how you've really never been to Benson. I don't go to New Ulm very often either. And we also have the address in predicament here in our Senate district that we are split by two congressional districts, and so we have both CD7 and CD1 here too, which makes it a little interesting as far as representation goes, how we can have it kind of split up and be different like that. But if you look at Mr. Vandercoy's statements on page 2 here, he talks about court services, legal services, corrections, health, transportation, how economic development and everything ties in county to county. And I know up in the cities, you guys are really tied in by your cities, and for us, and how the suburbs react to each other, and for us, our counties are almost splitting up our counties. It makes it a little hard just because that's almost how our communities tie in. And so I hope that gets taken into consideration, too, and maybe looking at what shared services are shared between counties can maybe also help signify where district lines can be drawn.
My real name is Alan Viss. Nobody knows me by that name, though. And I reside at Edgerton in Pipestone County. I had no idea. I'm totally unprepared coming to this meeting. I had no idea what the scope of the discussion would be. I lived in southwest Minnesota all my life, with the exception of the few years I was outside of the state for college, but I came back in 1960, and I've been on boards of every sort since, including a couple of terms as county commissioner. I want to go back, first of all, in the 1960s, I'm curious if anyone here remembers the Damian reports. That's right. We talked about that at the state conventions, Miller. Yes, okay. Dr. Damian had a very an exhaustive report about what he thought the demographics of Minnesota would be, and he at least was correct on this. About a territory about three, maybe four counties wide, but three counties wide, starting on the southwest corner, the Rock, Nobles, Jackson, about three counties wide, and you go halfway up the western quarter of Minnesota, would have a drastic reduction in population over the next 30 or 40 years. He was correct. He was the proponent, for example, of one school district per county. He was a proponent of, in the larger counties, to have like 24 passenger helicopters to haul children to a large school bus and then transport them. Well, that didn't go anywhere, but that has nothing to do with what I want to say about today's meeting. Constitutionally, I'm aware that you're going to have to devise district lines based on population. And there are a lot of things that are based on population. The importance of the census was really stressed this past year, and I'm hopeful that Minnesota did well, and it appears they did. But there are issues that are not, that are treated on a population basis, but sometimes they're extremely important, and they're not related to population. When I was a county commissioner, I recall that the state legislature at that time, we got letters from state legislators that had to do with the transportation money. And I'm not going to go into this, but you recall who decided the 6.5% sales tax. The county commissioners did. That was not a good situation, but that's another story. It looked to me, when we discussed a resolution, the 87 counties were made aware that the state transportation formula, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember it as being 62-29-9. 62% of the transportation-related taxes in the main were used and available to the state. 29% to the counties, and 9% of fuel taxes, for example, were used by cities of 5,000 or greater and townships. And we were fairly scolded if we were reluctant to be in favor of fuel tax increases. And in fact, there were some threats that if we didn't pass a resolution, the Association of Minnesota Counties Convention, to back the legislature for a gasoline tax increase, they would change the formula. We were threatened in the rural areas, you're not going to get that 29%. You'd be lucky to get 24 or 21 or something like that. I have a very good friend in the trucking business. He had six semi-trucks on the road, no big deal. I did his fuel reports. That put me in contact with the Transportation Department and the Department of Revenue, and I said, why would members of the legislature threaten the rural areas? We're going to cut you 29%. On what basis? Well, it's on the basis of revenues. When I would turn in that fuel report, the key to determine the origin of this revenue was the number 59. That's the number of Pipestone County. So Pipestone County would get, may I say, any fuel report turned in Pipestone County had a 59 on it, and that would help them to determine how many gallons of fuel were taxed by entities in Pipestone County. I drove truck for this good friend for a few years between my education years and getting into my own business. I helped out my good friend. We burned up most of the fuel in those trucks outside of Pipestone County, but Pipestone County got the credit. This thing went to work up here, and I knew truck lines. Some of them have since disappeared out of North St. Paul out there on County Road C and these terminals out there. They had 800, 900, 2,400 trucks. Some of them have moved out of state. But when they turned in their fuel reports, their county had a number. And that county got the credit for all the fuel burned in those trucks and for the license plates and for the excise taxes. Well, that's federal. But and the sales tax. And so our friends in the Twin Cities, our legislators, they said, see, look, this is where the revenue is, but where were those trucks running? All over the state. That's where they burned up that fuel, not in North St. Paul or in the Twin Cities area. Why do I bring this up? Anybody that lives in southwest Minnesota will understand there is enormous tonnage on our roads because of agriculture. And if you start making decisions based on population, or start or continue, this is irrational. These roads out here need more attention than they do. They have far, far, far more tonnage per capita than in the Twin Cities area. I was in a hotel up along 494, and I was just counting by fives in the rush hour how few trucks in comparison to the cars. So there's a lot of fuel there, but those cars don't need a very heavy-duty road. But these trucks out here, and my friend Buell over here, he knows the livestock to market, and the packing plants aren't in Minneapolis, St. Paul, they are scattered to the country. These ethanol plants, they're not in the Twin Cities, they're scattered throughout here. The farm products, and this is a huge business, this is a very, very large part of the Minnesota economy. So I'm not helping you draw any district lines here, but I don't get this opportunity as often as I used to. I get to talk to some legislators. Please keep in mind the needs of outstate Minnesota. We have some needs out here that are totally not dependent on the census. I was in the non-public school system in Edgerton, and while I was principal there in K through 8, we had our largest enrollment in that little school, in that little town of 1,000 people. We had 368 kids in K through 8. We had the largest number of families with two children in school. We had the next largest, it was about a tie between those with three children in school and one. We had several with four, we had two with six. Today, I don't know if it averages two per pupil, and the enrollment from this is in the early 1970s, went from 368 in the same school to, 2 years ago, 155. It's 175 today because a small school in a neighboring town closed and those kids come over. The farms are getting larger, the families are getting smaller, but we have infrastructure needs which are as great, if not greater, than ever. Many farmers now own their own semi-trucks to haul their produce. They used to, if a farmer had a truck, he was probably farming in Montana, I don't know. But keep in mind that we have needs that are as great or greater than ever, in spite of the fact that we have a declining population. I came unprepared, but I'm thankful I got to say a few things. Thank you so much.
I do appreciate the comments. Much of what you said I've heard from members like Representative Swazinski and Representative Pavian at the legislature, but I will certainly take back these comments to our chair and Representative Mike Berry.
By the way, at that convention was in 1996. My friend from Murray County kicked me in the ankle. He says, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to speak against that resolution. And he says, you're wasting your time. You have been keeping track, and for everyone that spoke against that resolution, to back the legislature in raising the taxes for everyone, for every three that were spoke against, there were seven in favor. I wasn't even finished with my time allotment. Someone got up at another microphone and says, I was at this microphone a few minutes ago favoring this. I changed my mind, and I make a motion we table this, and that killed a gasoline tax increase from 1996 until just recently. Why? Because the method that was used to promote it was that it was invalid. It was lacking in facts. So, thank you so much.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? Anyone else wishing to speak? Please come forward.
My name is Robert Mefford. I live in Marshall. The gentleman, Mr. Wiss, and I started teaching the same year, 1960, in Edgerton, Minnesota. I was at the public school and got to go to the state tournament as a band director standing on the floor of Williams Arena. Ended up in Marshall. I have a few comments to make regarding the idea of that there must be, I realize what the Constitution says about one man, one vote, but there are other issues that need representation. And I very vividly remember a gentleman by the name of Senator Everett Dirksen. Is anybody old enough in here to know that name? No? Read up.
No.
Read up. When that judicial decision came down, he had an amendment that passed both houses and got signed, but it didn't become law because it was lacking one state to ratify the amendment, realizing that both houses of state legislatures must be population only. It used to be the House by population, and in Minnesota, or counties, or something like that, like Congress, you know, that there's equal representation. Areas need representation. It's always interesting to me how when something comes along up in the Boundary Waters canoe area, the Twin City area is jumping all over what should be done up there. The same thing with the feedlots out here. Those kinds of things that true reality sometimes doesn't get brought forward or it gets slanted. And so I just toss that out to ratify his concern that those of us out here, those of you that drove out here, how many four-lane highways did you run coming out here? We're the only city, I believe, on the state official state map that isn't connected, you're 50 or 60 miles away to a four-lane highway. And we've got a Fortune 500 company in town. There was a story at one time about how, at least in the spring, two big semis full of ice cream would travel to Worthington half full. And they would back up to each other and load half of one onto the other one so they could take off and go across the country because of load limits and restrictions and no four-lane highways. That affects economics, and getting back to what he said. You make decisions based on economics, and yet how can we grow? I've always maintained the big companies that made Minneapolis and St. Paul, General Mills, General Foods, the packing plants, did nothing to generate that income, that wealth. The cows, the beans, the corn are out here. They just pushed paper up there. And so I guess that backs up my feeling towards Senator Dirksen and his amendment. What I I'm concerned about is I didn't get the whatever sheet that was that the gentleman had talking about the rules and regulations and deadlines and so on. One of the hats I wear is chairman of the political organization out here. And how does all this wash with caucuses coming up in February? I believe you gave me some April deadlines and so on. How do we start setting that up if we don't know what our boundaries are going to be in precincts and that sort of thing? So that would be a rhetorical question back. You've got your deadlines, but how does that mesh with state law that we're going to have to be operating under in literally less than 10 months?
I think based upon what happened 10 years ago, the individual parties make adjustments for the redistricting process. I guess that's the best I can speak to that. I guess your better bet would be to talk to your party. They can maybe answer those questions directly on how they would address those concerns, given the timeline that we have. But I would like to offer to you, we'll give you the handouts, you know, so you have it for your reference.
I've got this one, but I didn't have...
Let me give you the other one. And this is for everyone. If anyone has any questions that they don't want to share with us today, or put them later on after going home and mulling this over, I do encourage you to feel free to give me either a call or a letter or to email me. All of my information is on the state website for legislators. It's, my email address is rep.sarah.anderson@house.in, and I encourage you to do that. Please proceed if you have any other questions or comments.
Well, I guess my concern was just simply these decisions that we make regarding boundaries and candidates coming from and representing going on to congressional district conventions we elect our delegates from, and so on. And that certainly is controlled by our party systems, but it also represents an area. And so they don't, I mean, they're under the same deadlines that we need to go forward with something before we have the boundaries.
And I understand the urgency of this whole situation, and that's why, for us, our personal goal is to have a plan out this legislative session to try and get things underway, because we know that it's difficult, not only for your concern that you have, but certainly for our cities, our counties, and other local units of government in going through this process. So I hear what you're saying.
Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity, unless somebody has something to that I didn't explain clear enough.
Any questions, members, or anyone else?
Thank you kindly for your opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And folks, I just wanted to take the Does anybody else have any questions or comments? Or? No? Okay, go ahead. Feel free to come up. If you would please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is David Strzok. I'm professor of political science at Southwest Minnesota State University. Appreciate the chance to visit here. I should stipulate for the record, I am active in the Republican Party, but the comments I have here are entirely my own. Thank you for coming to Southwest Minnesota, and not just for the firm's sake, but 10 years ago, under a couple of governors removed, there was an advisory committee that drafted a districting plan for our U.S. House districts that ran the entire span of the state, from Manitoba to Iowa. And it was defended, that long shoestring district on the grounds, well, they grow all the same crops out there anyhow. Well, we of course do not. That is insulting to greater Minnesota, any part of greater Minnesota, that someone would be that cavalier, that casual, that unprofessional, to significant parts of our state. Obviously, you're following a very different path by coming out here, by coming out here early. We hope your Senate colleagues will do something similar. We'd love to visit with them as well. So thank you for that interest, for taking the process seriously, for treating Greater Minnesota seriously. My own credentials on talking about this, as a self-trained scholar on redistricting, going back even before the 1980 redistricting law, but for the four cycles since then, as someone who studied it closely, written about it, has been a volunteer advisor to legislators in several different states over the course of my career, and as someone who's vitally interested in making sure that our political process works the way it's intended to work for all parts of our state, but especially places like southwest Minnesota where the population is stagnant. And we recognize the realities of one man, one vote. You have to expand districts, expand footprints, and there's not much we can do about that numerically, but there are some things we should pay attention to in terms of how we do that and what the effects are. I understand Mr. Martin spoke earlier on behalf of the City of Marshall, had some data for you regarding measures of community of interest, such as commuting patterns, economic trading areas. I agree with that very much. Aside from the legally defined criteria you're supposed to follow, population, compactness, contiguity, community of interest is harder. That's slipperier, it's vaguer, of necessity, it's not a very precise measure. It doesn't mean that anyone should ignore it, however. And so the economic data are helpful. I might note also things like news media markets. Marshall Independent is here today. They are the only daily in this region, one of only six, I think, in all of western Minnesota. They circulate into three or four neighboring counties. That might be worth a look at some point. I imagine those data are fairly easily available. Where the focus of information that voters get in different parts of the state come from, how they're clustered, how they connect people together, has some sense of a community of interest in neighboring counties, I think has a practical effect, and maybe a significant guiding effect on how the districts should look to the extent that other considerations allow. So I encourage you to think about that. I'm a great believer in keeping counties intact. They are administratively simple to run elections. If you only have, such as a county out here, one House district to deal with rather than two or three or four, it reinforces the notion there's some kind of community of interest if you can respect county boundaries. But, like any other virtue, it's possible to take it too far. And I'd like to offer a couple of examples from the districts that have been in effect over this last decade. If you look at Senate District 22 to the south of us, Jim Vickerman and now Doug Magnus, it is a perfect district on the map. It is six whole counties, no fragments. It's like a shoebox, a rectangular, starting nestled in the southwest corner of the state, running eastward along Interstate 90 and north of that, one row of counties. That's a perfect validation of why you'd like to keep counties together as to the extent the population allows. On the other hand, the district to the north of us, Senate District 20, represented by Gary Kubley, by the numbers is a perfect district, seven whole counties, no fragments, but if you look at it on the map, it's looks more like a work of modern art. It splays around in a squiggly, irregular fashion from Mr. Falk's area, nestling against the South Dakota border, all the way through Renville County. If you get to the easternmost point of the district of Buffalo Lake, you are closer to Wisconsin than you are to areas within the same Senate district, such as the southern part of Lincoln County. And there's something wrong about that. Somebody who was looking at the direction of the judicial panel saw seven whole counties that fit the numerical swat and said, aha, let's put them together. Other considerations be darned. And that's a case where you want to temper the goal, the desire of having whole counties, a little bit of common sense, and very much tempered with some understanding of what communities of interest mean. Even if you can't define them precisely, you know them when you see them. And I would suggest Lake Benton and Buffalo Lake, it's a bit of a stretch to say they're a community of interest, at least if you're talking about something as small as a legislative district. So I hope you keep those things in mind as well. I won't presume to advise which way you should draw the lines. Mr. Cruz, Mr. Neffert, they have two different opinions from their respective parties about who Lyon County should be shared with in the next 10 years. Maybe Mr. Swadzinski might have a thought about it too. You can take us in different directions, which would create different kinds of political realities. And I have nothing to offer on that subject. I would simply encourage you to think about the considerations of community of interest There's one more aspect of communities of interest that nobody ever talks about in redistricting. But here, I think this is a place where it is appropriate to talk about politics and practical political considerations, not favoring one part or the other, but rather the realities of what it takes to go out and campaign. The perspective of being a candidate in a House, much less a Senate district in greater Minnesota, means you've got, pick your number, 3-4 county fairs to juggle, perhaps a dozen or more parades, you can double those numbers for a typical Senate district, countless church suppers, and great distances between all of them. To the extent that you can create districts that are, if you respect the community standards, contiguity, population numbers, then the politics, to a large degree, take care of themselves. Both parties will have their opportunities, and I'd be happy to, you know, but I mean, this is a great part of exercise with all these great software applications now, to draw districts that both parties would get good competitive districts. They wouldn't get exactly what they want, but the public interest would be served if those considerations prevail. And one way in which I think the campaign process is served is if particularly first-time candidates, an incumbent knows who to see, where to go, has somebody perhaps who keeps the lists maintained, all that stuff. But a first-time candidate, Mr. Falk and Mr. Swedzinski can both talk about this from recent experience, has a monstrous job in this part of the state, excuse me, trying to figure out the geography of who to see, where to go, and so on. To the extent you make your districts more compact, more reasonable in terms of community of interest, you make the process more accessible to newcomers. And that's a constant challenge for us in politics, I think. That's all I have to say. I thank you for your time and your attention. I'd be happy to visit with any of you if you have follow-up thoughts.
Thank you, Dr. Sorok. And my question is, are there significant geologic barriers within counties? We do find ourselves in the position of having to divide a county. I see on the map that there's a river running through the middle of 20A. And as I drove here down a big ridge, I mean, it just seems like there's some natural geographic areas that fit together.
Did you come to Gullett Falls and come into the Minnesota Valley? Okay. that is a striking geographic division. Yeah, the terrain, contrary to what folks in Metro think, we are not one big ironing board out here, and we got a good view of that today. There are rivers, some mountains, some hills, really. They don't matter a lot. I think rivers are helpful as demarkers in geography. I think Granite Falls is particularly unusual because the city actually crosses the river and into another county. If I had a preference from studying how a lot of these decisions have been made over the years, if you have, as we have here, cities which are divided by county lines or divided by rivers, I think the first consideration would be to keep the city together. And Granite Falls, these last 10 years, has been split, maybe even before that, by the river. Well, I think if it means splitting Chippewa County for the sake of keeping Granite Falls together, I think that might be a higher consideration. We don't have high mountain ranges or vast barrens of tundra to worry about out here. So I think, again, if you keep these other considerations in mind, the geography pretty much takes care of itself.
Representative Beatty,
you have a question? I would love to be able to keep the legislative districts compact.
Yes.
I represent District 1A. There's about 3,900 to 4,000 square miles in that.
Yeah.
And our population, with the numbers that we have to find about 8,000 people, I think, in our 7th district. And I don't think we're going to be able to do a myopic thing and divide it. Mm-hmm. Representative Dill, I know, represents about 10,000 square
right.
miles. It's very, very right. difficult. But I am very aware of the concerns that you have. What piqued my interest is when you were driving out here, Representative Scott made the comment at that point. It sure is flat around here. And I'm from Roseau, and I said, these are pretty big hills in Roseau. So anyway, I hear you saying
that. It is all relative in terms of which part of greater Minnesota you're in. We're not just one big back of the bison of the Centennial Quarter. Down here, we don't have very many lakes or trees or loons. But that's the postcard image of greater Minnesota, and it's much more varied than that. And your district, Representative Fagan, if I remember correctly, splits two counties for the sake of getting, I mean, you have a portion of Pennington County, and then you split one above you, and then two whole. Yeah, that sort of stuff shouldn't happen. He should have three whole counties and then a chunk of a fourth, not two holes and two splits, to the extent the geography allows you to think about those things. I'd encourage you to do that.
And I don't disagree with you, but I also don't disagree with Representative Portman, who said, you know, boy, if you have two representatives representing your county, you have more political power.
You do. I mean, there is that consideration. And
so wasn't the consideration.
Absolutely right. And those are perfectly fair to take account of. And the problem is you get, I mean, that makes good sense maybe for a county that's 50 or 100,000 people. At some point, you have to spread it. Down here, I mean, Lyon County at 25,000 is the biggest county for an hour around. And beyond a certain point, splitting us into two really does dilute us. We were split in the 1990 plans into three House districts in ways that were, I think, more political than good government. And I don't think that helped us particularly. So, this is my thought on that.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. Dr. Strick?
Yes, ma'am.
When you get around to doing your little maps with your software, I'd be interested in seeing what you do for Southwest and Northeast.
Oh boy, I'm not going to take on the Northeast. At least not too casual, but I'll be happy. Thank you.
Just for fun.
I thank you for the thought. I'll follow up with you with some information. I can send you to a couple of sites, and anybody can do it.
Yeah.
It's become a very, technology has made it a very open, accessible process. And I think that's a very healthy thing.
But Dr. Strick, I think it would be more interesting to have someone from another part of the state doing it rather than, of course I'll be doing it.
Of course.
Since I learned how to use the computer.
I think any of the dedicated staff here would love to get you up to speed on that. I'd be happy to share ideas with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Sir.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you very much,
and thank you all for coming out here.
Any other questions or comments from folks?
I'd like to plant a seed. I think you're ready to hear me. I'd like to plant a seed with a question. And it's this. Washington, D.C. is not based on one man, one vote, and it shouldn't be. We have a Senate and a House. But the Supreme Court said one man, one vote out here. So we have two of you for every one of our senators. And so this plan has to be approved by both. And that, I think, is the reason for some of these odd-shaped districts. And my question is, I am pretty convinced that your job would be made a whole lot easier since we just have a duplication of the Senate in the House. Well, we just have a House. Why don't we have a unicameral? And that would solve a lot of these problems. Your job would be easier. I'd love to see that tried.
Mr. Bissett, I know there's some legislators that would like to talk to you about that issue at some point. Is there any other questions or comments at all? If not, I want to thank you again for coming out and sharing your thoughts on this process. And please do not hesitate to contact me. Again, my email address is ref.sarah@house.mn. You can look me up on the internet as well, or contact Representative Swazinski. We can certainly help you out on this, and look forward to, once we get the numbers, putting together a fair plan for all Minnesotans. As we mentioned before, we reflect the population and demographic shifts that we have in the state. And just can't thank you enough for coming up. Thank you so much.